So this is the final meeting of our book club this year. And tonight we're discussing the poetry of Moja Kaf, her book, Emails from Scheherazade. So I'm going to have a little poetry here in my introduction. So I was talking with a friend, colleague, teacher yesterday about, you know, kind of this difficult time in the U.S. With the bomb threats and arson against Islamic and Jewish centers and all these decrees and bans and ongoing wars. But he gave me a little perspective maybe and compared the situation now to a birth, that maybe we just go through this, get through this, and something better and perhaps even beautiful might come. And then as I was reading the poetry, two of Kaf's two stanzas from one of her poems came to mind. She writes, "If the moon enters her darkest phases, we will continue to walk the earth, making our own small light wherever we go until her waxing time returns. I will continue to invite your children to play with my children. Will you continue to want your children to come and go with mine?" And so I wanted to thank each of you for being here and, you know, responding to the invitation to participate in this book group, to meet each other, to listen, and to share your understanding of the poems. So tonight, are there a few of you that haven't been here before? I think so. So the format is that we'll have about a half hour of lecture, and about quarter of eight, we're going to have about a 10-minute break. So that's a little different tonight, so you can get more refreshments and do what you need to do during that time. And then we're going to break into a few discussion groups. We're going to have one out in a conference room in the hallway, and we'll help you get there. And at the very end, we'll come back to this space and share some of the insights from our groups, and our scholar will answer any questions that we have. So I'm getting to the end of the introduction, but I really want to offer thanks to everyone who contributed to providing this opportunity: the Muslim Studies Program, Muhammad Khalil, the director, is here, the MSU Libraries, many staff members here and supporting this, the Interfaith Clergy Association of Greater Lansing, and the Islamic Society of Greater Lansing, who helped get the word out. A special thanks to our discussion group facilitators, Adrian Tyree, Jessica Kane, Jill Mansky, and a few who aren't here tonight: Allison Kaledzi, Asif Iqbal, and Jessica Ackberger. But I want to give extra special thanks to Leila Tarakji, tonight's presenter, who helped shape this series. Oh, hi. Oh. Okay, thanks. You're welcome. It's a pleasure. But extra thanks to Leila, who helped shape the series, and really she and Muhammad chose these readings, which have been really powerful. So if you're like just coming to this one, I mean, you have to read the autobiography of Malcolm X if you haven't read it, and the other ones also. So she, and also, you know, leading a session in January and a session now. So it's a pleasure to work with you, Leila, and to learn from you. And I have just a small gift for your daughter, but it's kind of like a mother-daughter kind of book. Unfortunately, her daughter isn't here today, which is the highlight of my day usually. So Leila Tarakji is a PhD candidate in the Department of English. Her research is committed toward the development of Muslim American literature studies and its role within a broader field of ethnic literary studies. She's especially interested in the self-representations and the diverse discourses expressed by Muslim Americans.
Thank you, Deborah, thank you for your kind words, and also thank you for putting everything together, and to Dr. Khalil, and for inviting me to participate. So today we're talking about Moja Kaf's poetry, the emails from Scheherazade. So I'd like to start off with one of her poems, The Marvelous Woman, which you see up here. And I think this poem nicely describes the inspiration behind her poetry. And she describes not only the marvelous women who inspire her to write in the poems that she writes, but also the significance and power of the poems themselves. So I'm just going to read a few lines. I'm going to kind of skip around a little bit, but this is the poem in its entirety. So she writes, "All women speak two languages, the language of men and the language of silent suffering. Some women speak a third, the language of queens. They are marvelous and they are my friends. My friends give me poetry. If it were not for them, I'd be a seamstress out of work. They send me their dresses and I sew together poems, enormous sails for ocean journeys. My marvelous friends, these women who are elegant and fix engines, who teach gynecology and literacy, and work in jails and sing and sculpt and paint the 99 names, who keep each other's secrets and pass on each other's spirits like small packets of leavening. It is from you I fashion poetry. I scoop up in handfuls glittering sequins that fall from your bodies. As you fall in love, marry, divorce, get custody, get cats, enter supreme courts of justice, argue with God. You rescuers on galloping steeds of the weak and the wounded, creatures of beauty and passion, powerful workers in love, you are the poems. Come with me, come with poetry, jump on this wild chariot, hurry, help me with these wayward snorting horses. Together we will pull across the sky, the sun that will make the earth radiant, or burn in its terrible brilliance, and that is a good way to die." So in one of the, about halfway through there, where she says, creatures of beauty and passion, powerful workers in love, you are the poems. So it's in that line that we see that not only are the marvelous woman the inspiration for the poems, but they also become the poems themselves. And then she ends with that call where she says, come with me, come with poetry, jump on this wild chariot, and so on. So the poems, their writers, and the marvelous woman who inspire them all pull the sun across the sky, carrying with them the light and the sustenance to make the earth radiant. And so in this way, this is how Qahf describes her work. She describes it as a heavenly responsibility and as a work to bridge together different lands and different peoples with the force of like her work, her writing, and the words themselves. So the sun is there, if you notice, right? But it's just, it needs someone to pull it across, right? And so that's the work of these women and the work of the poets and the poems. And so then through their efforts, that's how it reaches everyone. Similarly, that's sort of, you know, what the marvelous woman, they are doing these everyday things, they're teaching literacy and gynecology, they're sculpting, they're building, they're marrying and divorcing, falling in love, right, taking custody of different things. And so it's all these everyday things, but her purpose here is to illustrate these things and kind of highlight their marvelousness, and through her poetry, spread it across the world. And so that's her inspiration. In general, poetry offers us the opportunity for a transnational literary criticism. I'd like to point to a work by Jahan Ramazani, Transnational Poetics, where he argues that contemporary and modern poetry spanning the 20th and 21st centuries both reflect and creatively reshape transnational experience. He proposes that through poetry that there are different ways of bringing to life circuits of poetic connection and dialogue across political and geographic borders and hemispheres, and of examining cross-cultural and cross-national exchanges, influences, and confluences in poetry. And so poetry and our criticism of it, and by exploring it, offers us a means of identifying and tracing these circuits of exchange. So how are different peoples and with different backgrounds kind of coming together through in the lines of the poetry, traversing spatial and ideological boundaries across geographical, cultural, political, sexual, social divides. So all these things are kind of just coming together in the lines of the poetries. So the Muslim American poets function as a type of like these kind of go-betweens and this bridge between cultures and histories across these divides that we've talked about, and specifically as they engage with different Muslim cultures, histories, and societies that influence their works. So in this discussion, I hope to highlight some of these kind of how they bridge some of these crossings and divides and some of the dialogues that are taking place. The study of poetry is particularly significant in light of the history of Muslim civilization, where in the poetic tradition is characteristic of Quranic language and appears particularly in early Arabian society as well as in other Muslim cultures and civilizations that we see across time. So the Quran itself serves as a bedrock of Islamic tradition and civilization, and its Arabic language and teachings resonate across boundaries and kind of promoting different nuances as it kind of manifests across cultures. In the Arabian Peninsula in particular, poetry was the greatest cultural production before Islam. And so we saw that where like the birth of Islam, like in Mecca, this was like through poetry and the oral transmission of poetry, that's how values and traditions were often transmitted. And so for some of my quotes that I have up here, I refer to Ingrid Mattson's The Story of the Quran, which kind of goes into detail about the role of language in the Quran and its significance. So one of the things that she mentions is she talks about the oral impact of the Quran. And so she says, perhaps it's not even enough to say that the sound of this recitation is in harmony with the meaning of the words, but that the sound itself conveys meaning. So the rhythm, the assonance, the rhyming of the verses in the Quran, that actually contributes to its meaning. And so you see some, and so as she says, like the sound in itself kind of adds more meaning to the content itself. And so historically we've seen like accounts where the style and the eloquence of the Quran and the rhythm and all these poetic aspects of the Quran contribute to the people's accounts of how they were affected by its recitation and just the hearing of it. Also, this is one of the things that in Muslim tradition, one of the aspects is this idea that the Quran cannot be imitated, so it's inimitability, and that's part of that has to do with this idea that it's linguistic medium, so the language itself cannot be reproduced. And so I'd like to, just as an example, just kind of we can hear some of the rhyme and the poetic aspects of it. I'm going to pull this. This is a recitation of, so just kind of as an introduction, this is this chapter of the Quran is called Surah Al-Duha, the early morning hours. And it was revealed after, Prophet Muhammad, there was kind of a gap in revelation. And so he was kind of in the emotional distress where, he thought maybe he had done something wrong because there was kind of connection between him and God had been kind of, had ceased for a considerable period of time. And so then when this chapter was revealed, the tone, the rhyme, and it's very gentle and it's sort of comforting, I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. But I just want us to hear it, and it's I wanted the translation to be included, so it's kind of broken up by the translation, but that's all right.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. By the morning brightness. And by the night when it covers with darkness. Your Lord has not taken leave of you, O Muhammad, nor has he detested you. And the hereafter is better for you than the first life. And your Lord is going to give you, and you will be satisfied. Did he not find you an orphan and give you refuge? وَوَجَدَكَ ضَالًّا فَهَدَى And he found you lost and guided you.
وَوَجَدَكَ عَائِلًا فَأَغْنَى
he found you poor and made you self-sufficient. So as for the orphan, do not oppress him. And as for the petitioner, do not repel him. But as for the favor of your Lord, report it.
All right, so you might have noticed in the... So at the endings of the verses, so the first, I think the first eight verses, so they end, they all have a similar ending. So والضحى سجى قلى أولى طردى هدى, they all there's that rhyme that the first eight. So it's kind of this, and they're very short verses as well. And if you read the translation as well, it's you know, there's this, you know, your Lord has not forsaken you. Didn't he find you an orphan and kind of give you a refuge? He found you lost and kind of gave you guidance, right? So all these things, there's this like comforting meaning. And then after those first eight verses, the tone shifts a little bit, and you notice the syllables become a lot shorter, the consonants also shorter, and it's much more direct, and it kind of switches into kind of action mode. So, all right, you know, we've comforted you, now take action, you know, take care of the orphan and the poor and so on. And so those endings are very much, they're much more not as... the rhyme changes, right? So it's فَلَا تَقْهَرْ وَنْحَرْ, right? So like it's very, again, like more of a commanding tone. So that's just a, kind of an example of how like the poetics of the Quran itself is kind of influencing the literatures, the poetic tradition that we see across Muslim civilization. So there are, of course, other poetic traditions, so including like Persian, Turkish, Urdu poetry that's, you know, that spans back for, you know, centuries and to pre-Islam as well. And all of these linguistic traditions in different ways were also enriched by this like Quranic influence, like after, like down the road in different ways. So I want to take us to a really great website here that's called the Poetic Voices of the Muslim World. So when you have a chance, like check this out at your leisure. So actually, Josna introduced this really great resource to me. So it's kind of like a digital exhibition of you know, poetry across the Muslim world. You know, reaching back to history, centuries back. And so it's really nice. It has a lot of resources, and you can kind of also listen. There's an option down here to listen to, you know, different lectures that were given as this kind of exhibition was, you know, shown in different cities. So it has different sections. So I'm kind of introducing to this too. So again, you can kind of go look at this, explore this later on your own. But it starts off with origins, so roots of Islamic poetry, the Quran and Arabic literary culture, a little bit of kind of more of what we were just kind of talking about. Traditions, so different types of poetry, like epic and romance, the qasida, Sufi verses and hymns, the ghazal, contemporary folk traditions, innovations and dialogues between East and West, poets of the 20th century. And so through this, as you kind of scroll through this, you get exposed to a lot, you know, different poets from across time, and a lot of modern ones as well. Engagement between poetry and politics, and migrations and adaptations, which is where you see a lot of the Muslim American poets. So, so here's actually the chapter that we just listened to. So this gives us different examples of, like I said, different types of poetry. So, like this is the famous, you know, epic romance of Layla and Majnun, or Majnun Layla, which is kind of, you know, find in like Arabic traditional poetry and like Urdu and Persian. Uh, So I'm just going to kind of skip down here a little bit. So this section I thought was interesting. It talks about the intersection between poetry and politics. So this opening line, if one day people desires to live, then fate will answer their call. So this line is from a Tunisian poet, Abul Qasim al-Shabi, dates back to, that period of time, early 20th century. But this line was very famous during the Arab Spring protests. And so this line was kind of repeated like in Tahrir Square and throughout the Middle East to kind of as they were protesting their government, stuff like that. So just interesting to see how that kind of came into play. So I didn't know where that line came from. And I was looking at this. I was like, hey, I recognize that when I was reading the translation. And then so it was just interesting to kind of read some of that background. So here you have like Faiz Ahmed Faiz, an Urdu poet, Mahmoud Darwish, famous Palestinian poet. And then here, I'm going to skip down to the Muslim American section, which is kind of a little bit more our focus. So here, Kazim Ali, he wrote that the first language of poetry I heard was the language of prayer, my father reciting from the Quran and other scripture. Part of poetry will always, for me, have the rhythms of these long lines, the structure of those couplets, the second line answering the first in some way, usually not merely narrative, also the strangeness of a language I do not understand, clotted with consonants that do not exist in English, modulated by vowels that English-speaking throats can rarely manage. So just kind of, again, connecting, making that connection between some of the like more traditional Islamic observances and then the poetry that inspires. So here's Kazim Ali, Sholeh Wolpe, Amiri Baraka. So just some kind of names that you may or may not be familiar with. I'm not going to be going into their poetry at all, really. And Ali Shahid Ali. But just some names that you might come across and kind of explore further on your own. And then here is Mohaj Al-Qahab. Okay, so that's for you guys to kind of look into on your own, poetic voices of the Muslim world. All right, by exploring the poetic tradition in particular within Muslim American literature, I think the idea is that this will help to highlight and further the dialogues that exist in America today between Muslim Americans and the rest of the national community, but also within the Muslim community itself as well. And I think this is particularly crucial considering today's political climate and rhetoric and some of the kind of repercussions that we've witnessed, as Deborah mentioned, like with the Islamic centers and the Muslim American community today. So poetry is kind of an interesting way to kind of delve into that, and I think a fun way as well, which is... Khalid Mutawa, who is himself a published poet and a creative professor at the University of Michigan here in Ann Arbor, he wrote an article titled Writing Islam in Contemporary American Poetry, where he looks at Mohaj Al-Qahaf, Agha Shahid Ali, and Daniel Moore. And he describes these authors saying that the authors of this body of literature, specifically referring to Muslim literature in the West, are outside two folds. He says that they're outside the Western literature, per se, and also outside of the literatures of their Muslim societies of origin. So he asks, how do Muslim authors, specifically poets, fashion a voice when they are writing mostly to outsiders? What subject matter will they treat, and in what manner? So I think that's kind of an interesting issue that we might get into later in the discussion, this issue of, are they writing as outsiders? Are they, do you agree or not? Do you think that Mohaj Al-Qahaf, is she always an outsider? Does she always take that position? Or does she kind of, become, is she a part of the society that she's addressing or speaking about and so on? So looking specifically at Muhajir Qahaf, so she was born in 1967. She grew up in a devout Muslim household in Damascus, Syria, and she relocated to the U.S. when she was 3 years old. So she discusses stereotypes in her poetry, in her works in general, actually, about Muslims and Arabs. She looks at, you know, the issue of victimized women, terrorism, all these things, looks at stereotypes and tries to, dismantle them in her works. She looks at both American and Islamic poetic traditions, as well as global popular culture that she uses and draws upon in her work. And she looks at issues related to Islam, modesty, morality, gender relations, sexuality, politics, and identity, Muslim, American identity, and Syrian, Arab, all sorts of things that she draws on. So a lot of these issues kind of are, you see across her works. So she has a nonfiction scholarly work titled Western Representation of the Muslim Woman from Termagant to Odalisque in 1999, Emails from Scheherazade, which we read, a novel, Girl in a Tangerine Scarf, and then Hajar Poems, which is a new collection of poetry that was just recently published in 2016. So some of the themes that she explores in, for instance, like Western representations of the Muslim woman, she looks at how the Western image of the Muslim woman has changed over time from one of assertiveness, so where the Muslim woman was kind of this bold, like wanton woman who was very sexually intimidating, to one of passivity. So it hasn't always been, the Muslim woman hasn't always had this image of, being kind of oppressed, in need of liberation, the idea of like the veil as oppression and the harems. That's kind of, doesn't really appear until about the 17th century. And so earlier than that, she's kind of arguing that, attributing everything to Orientalism in terms of the way that Muslim women are represented is inaccurate, considering the historical literature. So as she addresses a largely Western audience, she presents portraits of seemingly intolerable Muslims, and we see this in some of her poetry, and through them challenges the contemporary diversity discourse to try to make room for them. So for instance, in the poem, My Body Is Not Your Battleground, Qahaf, who she describes herself as a feminist and as a Muslim writer, critiques both Western and Muslim patriarchies. And she demands that imperialist Westerners and their moral equivalents, that they stop using Muslim female body as pretense for political violence. And kind of argues that that has nothing to do with the liberation of women and Muslim women in particular. So as we look at her poetry, the individual kind of localized meanings of the text can't be separated from the kind of broader like histories and processes that shape them. And so one of the things that I think is really interesting is the way that we see kind of the histories that come together in her poem, and in this poem in particular as an example. So this poem is called My Grandmother Washes Her Feet in the Sink of the Bathroom at Sears, which is one of my favorites in the text. And so one of the things that I think that her poetry encourages us to do is, rather than focus on this kind of manufactured clash of civilizations, that we need to concentrate on kind of how our cultures work together, how they overlap, and the exchange that we find between peoples and across time, how we borrow from each other, how we live together, and kind of the understanding that we can gain from that. So among other things, the history of Muslim Americans and Muslims in general is the history of, where you see different cultures kind of coming together and we see that exchange happen. In a global context, Muslims assume an array of ethnic and national identities that have evolved over the 14th century span of Islamic history. So in this poem, she calls forth architectural relics of Muslim civilizations from around the world. So she's in her, the narrator's grandmother is in the public bathroom making wudu, which is the obligatory ablution, the ritual ablution that she has to make before before prayer. And so she has to do this because, as you may know, so you know there are five prayers in the day, and there's specific times for them. So she's shopping at Sears. It's prayer time. If she doesn't pray now, she's going to miss the prayer time, right? So it's very, you know, a practical situation that a lot of Muslims find themselves in. And so she says, so as she delicately washes her foot in the sink, she perceives the critical judgment in the looks of the other Sears matrons. And she says, my grandmother, though she speaks no English, catches their meaning, and her look in the mirror says, I have washed my feet over Iznik tile in Istanbul with water from the world's ancient irrigation systems. I have washed my feet in the bathhouses of Damascus over painted bowls imported from China among the best families of Aleppo. So as she looks into the mirror, it's the magnificent cultures and histories of Istanbul, Damascus, China, and Aleppo that are all kind of reflected back and looking back at her. So that's kind of, you know, it's that history, those cultures, those civilizations that are all coming into play and, you know, just, you know, by her washing her foot in the Sears bathroom sink. So these great centers of Muslim civilizations are suddenly made to appear there, and so traditional measures of like nearness and distance become obsolete as kind of history and geography kind of all kind of collide and come together, and we have this bridging of both time and place in this image. And where the Muslim figure is often homogenized across social, political, and you know, literary representations, here we're invited to witness both the specificity and the richness of Muslim civilization in its cultures. Also in this poem, we see an interesting kind of permeability of the kind of public-private divide in her poem. So one of the things, and so as we mentioned, you know, like Muslims observing the requirement for prayer, and so we have this kind of moment where what might be considered as something that's private becomes public. And so in this way, kind of the Muslim way of life is kind of, it becomes very public in this moment. So like prayer, which something normally that's considered might be considered private is necessarily also public in this moment. So here there's another poem that I'd like to kind of talk about a little bit, but I found a performance of the poem by Mohja, and I thought this would be interesting to hear from her. And also, she has an interesting character, so can kind of take a look at that. So this is Fayetteville, as in fate.
First moved to Fayetteville, Arkansas, I soon learned to say it, Fayetteville, as in fate. I came into town the American way, the immigrant way, the upwardly mobile Bedouin trekking across the highway. I moved here from New Jersey and I like it just fine, although I do miss belligerent store clerks and being able to rent Ebifo Ishagara at the Egyptian video / pizzeria / travel agency / check cashing service / grocery store. I miss being able to practice my Urdu with random gas station attendants, although once a random Walmart associate here told me shukran and turned out to have known the Naya. That's fate. It is Fayetteville, as in fate. There is Cherokee and Choctaw here around the rims of people's eyes. There is Spain and France left in the names of things. There is Wild West and Old South here. Sometimes the music of the Ozarks spills down the mountainside, and it is green and brown, and I think I hear it. I hear people pick poke here, and my family memory stirs with people who picked the wild herbs, vachabezes, of other mountains. Whole populations of seed sowers and herb knowers, some of them from Damascus, Syria, and some of them from Fayetteville, Arkansas, meet in my head like the walls of the Red Sea crashing together. I roll dizzily toward them like the bowling ball of a very bad bowler. I mix metaphors among them like a reckless cook throwing things into a pot, hoping they don't explode when they touch each other, hoping they don't turn bitter when the heat rises. Their names and their languages are wildly different, and they believe vile and improbable things about each other. But see the turn of wrist when a woman from here or a woman from there needs dough. Although the bread will be twisted into different shapes for the baking, the hands move with a similar knowledge. See how a farmer takes up a handful of dirt? This one wears a serwal, and that one wears overalls. But the open hand with the dirt in its creases makes a map. Both can read. But who will coax them close enough to know this? Darling, it is poetry. Darling, I am a poet. It is my fate. Like this, to kiss the creases around the eyes, and the eyes that they may recognize one another. May their children email one another and not bomb one another. May they download each other's mother's bread recipes. May they sell yams and yogurts to each other at a conscionable profit. May they learn each other's tongues and put words into each other's mouths. Say amen, say ameen. Say it, say it.
You guys believe me when I said she's a character? I think we're close to wrapping up for discussion, but maybe we can get into this in the discussion. But I think that this poem is really interesting in the way that it brings in, incorporates language and dialogue. So you have different languages coming in, you know, like the shopkeeper, you know, saying shukran, thank you, in Arabic. You know, she misses the Urdu. You know, she's talking about mixing metaphors and mixing different languages and how she's hoping that they don't kind of collide and explode in her head, right? And then in those concluding lines where she says, you know, there's those lines of prayer that she makes, and she says, may they learn each other's tongue and put words into each other's mouth. So it's very kind of intimate, very, like a very immediate exchange of language, right? May they put words into each other's mouths. Also very like sensual in that way. And if you look at the actual text in the end where she says say amen and then say ameen, she has ameen written in Arabic, right? And so even the text itself is bringing in that kind of other language, right? And so again, just as kind of as an example of where we see that exchange of dialogue and language take place in this like very in this poem about, you know, coming, you know, as an immigrant, and kind of adjusting to that life and looking back at those memories of those, you know, her first days there in Fayetteville. So I'll kind of wrap up, and I just want to point us towards the discussion questions. So I'm just going to kind of quickly introduce them, and then I think we can continue.
Take a 5-minute break.
Okay.
And then come back to the discussion.
Okay. All right. So I have five questions here. So number one, emails from Shahrazad Mahajalqa have presents us with a collection of voices. And so how does this collection of poetry characterize Islam and complicate our understanding of it? What does it mean to be Muslim American in the text, and how is it expressed? And how is it expressed in different ways? And are there, you know, conflicting ways? Is there one narrative that's being told? Is it one story? Or does it resist that one narrative? Also, consider the significance of the genre, specifically, like, you know, what, you know, does the fact that we are reading poetry, does that add to it? Does that contribute to this narrative that we're talking about? You know, what kind of significance does that bring into play? Number two, discuss the intricate relationship between Muslim women, their faith, their bodies, and their American and Muslim societies that come to light in these poems. So I kind of broke it up into two parts. A, what does Qahf attempt to tell us about how this relationship is normally read? So the relationship between Muslim women, you know, their faith, Islam, and their body. And how does she respond to this in her writing? And B, by choosing to wear the hijab, some say that Muslim women visibly mark themselves as other, and in doing so prevent themselves from being American. So it's kind of a willful rejection of that American identity. Using the hijab scene's poems as a starting point, and, you know, please feel free to kind of look at other poems as well, consider how Muslim women respond to this notion and reclaim both Muslim and American identities. Number three, Move Over closes with a tone of confidence and anticipation, where she says, "We will intermarry and commingle and multiply. Oh, how we'll multiply, Muhammad lovers in the motley miscellany of the land." How do the speakers of these poems define a communal self? So where is this kind of pluralistic identity coming into play? Consider the significance of community in the various ways it appears throughout the text. How do the subjects of these poems imagine themselves as an integral part of America's future and evolving landscape? So community, like Muslim community, Muslim American, you know, all sorts of variations, immigrant communities also. And then in the poem that we looked at, "My Grandmother Washes Her Feet in the Sink of the Bathroom at Sears," Qahf calls forth, you know, she brings forth those different relics of Muslim civilizations, as we discussed. So how does she situate herself within a history of Muslim civilizations that span centuries, not only in this poem, but in other poems as well? And why does she do that? Why is that important? Discuss other textual examples that illustrate deep links to roots, memories, and histories. And so I felt like this was a recurring theme throughout the text, this kind of look back and very, like, nostalgic look at different, you know, personal histories, but then also a history of, you know, her people, her family. Also, how is the notion of home complicated by realities of immigration, which I think is very relevant today, and especially in the community that we live in, where we have a very large immigrant population, and specifically recently a large, actually not very recently, but a refugee population as well. So kind of also thinking about how, you know, thinking of that in a practical context. And then finally, the narrator tells us that Shahrazad does not tell bedtime stories meant to please and soothe. Rather, she, quote, "awakens the demons under your bed and forces you to grapple with them." In facing these demons and the terrors that come from within you and within her, you are able to journey to the reef of extremity, to the valley of all that is possible, landing in a field where you wrestle with Iblis. Iblis is the Arabic word for the devil. What does this collection of poetry accomplish? Why the title "Email from Shahrazad"? How do themes of language and storytelling arise in the text? So why? How is that, you know, a critical kind of theme and symbol throughout the text? And then also, you know, in those lines, she describes, you know, what Shahrazad does in her storytelling as a very personal thing. Like, you know, she's engaging you as her reader, as her audience. So, you know, how does that actually, you know, happen? Like, how were you affected by her poetry? Does she, how did they speak to you personally? What were your favorites? So this is kind of more personal take as a concluding question. Did they indeed awaken the demons under your bed, provoking certain memories and experiences? If so, how and why? All right, so I think we have a 5-minute break, and then we'll reconvene. Thank you all.